Hello, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. It's a unseasonably warm evening here in Chicago, only about 35 degrees, so I'm taking the opportunity to do some beachside ruminating on the subject of yesterday's brief reading from Capital Volume 1. There's a few things I want to summarize and draw my and our attention to. The first was a few points that I made about Hegel and the relationship between Marx's project and Capital Volume 1 and certain core features of Hegel's epistemology. I think yesterday I got caught up in the heat of things and I stated several things about Hegel a little imprecisely, so I want to clarify some of that. So the first just concerns this distinction between the universal and the particular, and what I mean when I say that Hegel thinks that the universal is concrete. So many philosophers will distinguish between what they call the particular and the universal. You can think of universals as being like properties or features. And then the particulars are those things that properties or features apply to. So properties or features are called universals because they are universal across instantiations, or they're universal across particulars. And they're typically considered to be abstract because they don't exist in the world independently of the things that instantiate them. So yesterday I talked about apples, fire hydrants, and stop signs, all of which might be red. And so sort of typical understanding of what a universal is would be, well, the universal redness is that common feature shared by these various instantiations. Okay, and then I said that Hegel didn't like this because he said that that was an abstract universal and he was interested in a concrete universal. The difference really has to do with the direction of derivation. So in the case of the abstract universal that I just described, the universal is gotten by taking away or abstracting a common element from the particulars that you encounter. Hegel is interested in what he calls a concrete universal because he thinks the concrete universal is that which produces or gives rise to or entails its own particulars. That's a very strange notion, hard to wrap your head around, but that's what it is. And Hegel thinks that to really know something, you need to comprehend that thing's concept, what he would call its concept, and how that concept gives rise to or entails the various particulars that it does. So just as a silly toy example, we can think about muffins or something like that. So if I wanted to learn sort of about what muffins are, how would I do that? Well, one way I might do that is I could go and I could look at lots of different muffins in the world, and then I could generalize across those muffins and abstract away certain general features of them. And then I would know something about what generally is the case of muffins. Hegel will reject that, and in fact there's an interesting point there to be made about empiricism. Hegel would probably say that what I just described there, that process of looking at all of the muffins and then generalizing across them, is actually incoherent. Because before I can look at lots of muffins and abstract away features from them, I actually have to know what a muffin is. So there's a way in which the concept of the thing actually precedes the observation of the thing. I can't observe something if I don't know what it is that I'm observing. So rather than abstracting concepts from observation, Hegel would say you have to actually have certain concepts in place before you can observe at all. Kant also has a sort of similar notion, incidentally, but Kant and Hegel are importantly different. Okay, so central to Hegel's epistemology is this notion that to really understand something, you have to understand its concept, and you have to understand how that concept gives rise to the particulars that it subsumes. That's what he means by the concrete universal, the universal that is active and productive, rather than merely abstract, the universal that really is in the world. Okay, now how does that relate to Marx? Well, Marx, if you know a little bit about Marx, you might know that he is very famously an empiricist, whereas Hegel is an idealist. So I think that there's an interesting problem to be chewed on in Marx's thought, where Marx seems to retain from Hegel this idea that to really know an object of study, in this case capitalism, it's not enough to just look at the world as it is. You know, I can't just go around looking at capitalist society as it appears to me and then generalize from there to learn about what capitalism really is. Instead, I have to understand the logic of capitalism. I have to understand capitalism's concept. And then I need to understand how it is that all of the various things that I see going on in capitalist society are related to, and perhaps even implied by, this very general concept of capitalism. And then another aspect of this is that Hegel thinks that concepts are developmental. They have a sort of life of their own, if you will. And so, you know, if you Hegel doesn't write about, you know, muffins, of course, but he writes about very abstract philosophical ideas like being and essence. And if you read his logical works, the Science of Logic or the Encyclopedia of Logic, you'll find that he has this account whereby a concept like being generates internally to itself contradictions, and these contradictions imply a certain resolution in a successor concept, in this case, essence. And then after you do this a lot, after you do philosophy a whole bunch, you come to the end of this long process and you realize that all of these intermediate concepts along the way, being, essence, and so forth, were actually, they were particulars. They were necessary moments of this this universal concept at the end that necessarily subsumes and gives rise to these particular stages. So understanding something is also a process of understanding something as a process and a process of coming to be and passing away. And I think you see this as well in Marx, where he's interested in how certain forms of society or certain social forms come to be, manifest according to a certain logic, and then pass away. And that's interesting because that's actually at odds with how I would say most contemporary social science proceeds, or at least as most contemporary social science imagines itself to proceed. Let's put it that way. That's a little more accurate. Most contemporary social science imagines itself to proceed by way of abstract generalization. You know, so you look at, quote, the data, and then you make some generalizations from, quote, the data. There's a way in which Marx is going to be very suspicious of the, quote, data. Because the data is a sort of mere given, and you actually need to know how what is given came to be and the logics outside of it that give rise to that data or that given. Okay, so how do we see this manifest in the first few pages of Capital? Well, recall there was that sort of... Well, let's think about the first two words of Capital Volume 1. The first two words of Capital Volume 1 were the wealth. The wealth of what? Capitalist societies. And it's the same in German, too. Die Reichtum. Yeah, that means the wealth in German. So Marx's subject in the first chapter is wealth. And he identifies, I guess, two aspects of wealth. So the first aspect of wealth that he identifies, he calls wealth's content. And so by content, he seems to mean that which is stable across times and places. So no matter what type of society you look at, any community of human beings. Sorry, I don't know if you can hear that. There's like an airplane going overhead. In any case, so the content of wealth is the same for all human communities in time and space. And what is that? The content of wealth is use value. That's what Marx says. The content of value is, or the content of wealth is use value. And what is a use value? A use value is an ensemble of properties in an object that may be put to various uses. I also noted that in Marx's discussion of use value, there's an interesting sort of side point where use or utility, the usefulness of something, also has a social character. The usefulness of a thing does not hang in the air, as Marx says. Es hängt nicht in der Luft, right? So the usefulness of a thing is conditioned both by its sensuous properties, but it's also conditioned by its sociality. There's a sociality of use, right? So what needs I have, what desires I have, is conditioned by the social situation that I'm in. And therefore, the uses to which objects are put is also socially conditioned, right? So you can think about the same bundle of sensuous properties, gold, for example. And you'll find that gold has different use values in different social settings, right? So in a lot of societies, gold is never, you know, filthy lucre like it becomes in many European societies. Gold is for ceremonial purposes, or it's for beautification, it's jewelry, right? So you can have the same sensuous properties take on different use values in different social settings. But in any case, Marx will say, for human societies in general, the content of their wealth is use values. But Marx identifies another aspect of wealth, and that's the social form of wealth, right? So the way that these use values appear changes in different social arrangements, right? And of course, what Marx is interested in the form of wealth as it appears in the capitalist mode of society. And so this leads Marx to identify what wealth looks like in capitalism. And in capitalism, wealth looks like commodities. That's what wealth is in capitalism. And the commodity, according to Marx, has a dual character. It has a use value, and that is normal. We should expect that, because all wealth in all societies, according to Marx, is a use value. But the commodity has another peculiar feature distinct from its use value, and that is value, or exchange value, right? So, for example, I'm giving this little soliloquy into this microphone, and so I consider this object from two perspectives. One is as a thing that has a certain use, namely that it is useful for taking with me while I walk on the beach and talk about Marx. But I also consider it from a different angle, namely its value or its price, right? $36.99. That's how much it cost. So it's both a use value and also a value. And as a value, it is the same. It's equal to, it's identical to every other thing that also costs $36.99. That's what it's worth, $36.99. And we saw that Marx found that very mysterious. You know, how is it that I can equate different, how is it that I can equate qualitatively different things? That's weird, right? There's the saying, you can't compare apples to oranges. Well, in a capitalist economy, we compare apples to oranges all the time. Three oranges is worth $6, and five apples is also $6, right? So there, I just equated apples to oranges. They're both six, right? And Marx finds that very, very mysterious. How do we do that, asks Marx. Well, it can't be according to any actual physical features or useful properties that they share in common. That's why he has that whole tedious section about what a property is and what a thing is. A thing is just a bundle of immediately perceptible useful properties. So the basis on which I equate apples to oranges can't be in their tangible features. It has to be in something else. And that something else is the social form that use values take on under capitalism, namely their value. And so I think Marx wants to emphasize that this thing according to which we equate commodities under capitalism is not in the commodities themselves. It's in something about our social organization. There's something about our social organization and our collective mode of producing and exchanging goods that bestows objects with this abstract quality of having a value. And Marx calls that a phantom-like or a ghost-like objectivity, a gespenstige Gegenständlichkeit. Gespenstige means ghost-like, and Gegenständlichkeit means roughly objectivity. Although actually there's an interesting side note here about some of the German etymology. Gegenstand, as in Gegenständlichkeit, is one of the German words that gets translated as object. In German, there's two words that can be translated as object: Objekt and Gegenstand. And Gegenstand, the word that Marx uses here, has in it as a root that word Gegen, and that means like against or opposed. So a Gegenstand is more like an external state of affairs, whereas Objekt is like something you act upon. So that's a little subtle nuance in the meaning there. The Objekt, the object in German, is intrinsically related to the subject, die Subjekt. So subject and object in that sense form this kind of pair. You can't have a subject without an object. You can't have a doer without something that is upon which something is done, and vice versa. But Gegenstand is different. Gegenstand is a sort of a dispassionate externality. Okay, and he calls value a ghost-like Gegenständlichkeit. Interesting. So where does this ghost-like objectivity that is value come from? We don't know. We can't touch it. We can't see it. We can't feel it. Yet we act according to it all the time. Let's see what else. And moreover, Marx then gets into what is frequently referred to as the beginnings of his labor theory of value. And if you go online, you can read all about the labor theory of value. But I think at this point in Marx, we don't have the labor theory of value. And in fact, I'm not convinced that we ever really get a labor theory of value in Marx. So that's something to pay attention to as we read. Do we really get a quote, labor theory of value? Because I at least the way I read Capital, it's more about the expounding of a riddle than it is the presentation of a theory. And you see that in the writing style. Always Marx is presenting something to you and then contradicting it or qualifying it or trying to turn what seems obvious into something mysterious. And I think you see that with value. But in any case, right about where we left off, Marx had asserted that there is one feature that all commodities share in common, namely that they are the products of human labor. But they can't just be products of human labor exactly, right? Because actually, just as all commodities are different qualitatively, so too laboring processes are also qualitatively different. So when we say that all commodities are a product of labor, we're saying that they're products of labor in the abstract. They're not products of any particular labor. Commodities in general are, let me rephrase that. Specific commodities are the products of specific labor processes. Commodities in general are the product of labor in general. And so from this, Marx suggests that commodities in capitalism appear as fractions of human labor in the abstract. He uses a very interesting word for this, calls it ein bloße Galerte, right? So and Galert is literally like, it's like pudding. So it's like a sort of, he says that human labor under capitalism takes on the form of a pale pudding. Literally, that's what he calls it. You know, it's this pale pudding is what human labor becomes in capitalism. And then a commodity is sort of a fraction or a crystal of that dead blob, that dead labor blob. And again, that's how it appears under capitalism. That's the form that wealth takes under capitalism. The form of wealth under capitalism is a collection of use values that represent a value, and that value corresponds to a fraction of the total labor pool in the abstract. He calls it this residue of concrete labor. That's what value is. And so finally, we've talked a little bit about Hegel again. We've talked about how Hegel's epistemological framework might be informing Marx's goals in Capital, and we've talked about the distinction between the general content and the specific social form of wealth. And then finally, on the sort of literary side, I want to just remind you that there's this very beautiful and kind of unsettling Gothic character to the way that Marx describes a lot of this, even in that language of the residue, right? What is a residue? A residue is something that's left over after all of the life has been squeezed out of it. And that's what Marx says value is. It's this residue left over after all of the life in labor has been abstracted away. And later we'll see more of this Gothic language, this language of vampires and demons that haunts Capital. All right, and so with that, I will see you on the other side, and we will get to reading some more of Capital line by line.